We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is the second hour of our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us this morning. This week on the campus of the University of Illinois, there is a week-long celebration of African writers going on. It's a festival that will be happening now every other year. This is the very first. It is jointly sponsored by the Department of Theater and the Center for African Studies at the U of I. It's something that they hope in the future will be celebrating and acknowledging the writing of writers of the African diaspora. And this first event particularly is concentrating on women writers and their work, plays, novels, poetry, short stories. We are pleased to have this morning in this hour of the show as our guests two of the participants for the festival. Both of them are from South Africa, Malika Ndlovu and Chantal Snyman. Malika is a poet, playwright. She has two poetry anthologies, Born in Africa But and Womb to World, A Labor of Love. Womb to World, yes, A Labor of Love. Besides pieces featured in many local and international publications, she's founder, member of a Cape Town-based women's writers collective, Weave. Chantal is artist and cultural worker. She's founder of the Wentworth Arts and Culture Organization and of the community theater company called The Company. She's performed in many productions staged at the Playhouse in Durban, including Malika's play, A Colored Place, also Snapshots, Women of Mud, and others. And both of them have done various kinds of things. We'll try to get a little bit better picture of them. If you're interested in finding out more about them or about the festival, perhaps the easiest thing that you can do, as long as you have internet access, is you can either go to the website of the Department of Theater at the U of I or of African Studies, Center for African Studies, and I'm sure you can find a complete rundown of all of the events in connection with this festival. And there will be performances. There'll be a lot of things going on. Everything is all free and open to the public, so anybody who is interested in taking advantage of this certainly should do this. It's a great and very special and unique kind of event. One of the great things about being here at the University of Illinois is things like this happen, and folks who are in the area can take advantage of them. So we're very pleased that the two of them could be here in the studio and talk with us. And questions are welcome, too. If people who are listening want to be involved in the conversation, that's easy to do. 333-9455 is the local number. Toll-free 800-222-9455. That's for the that's the toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. And we also have email, so you can contact us that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
Pleasure to be here, Ed.
It's a very a rare opportunity for us and for people here to hear from you, to see you perform and talk about your work. So it's great for you to be here. I thought it might be interesting, just as a way of starting out, if each of you could talk a little bit about your growing up and about at what point and would there have been a particular point that you decided that you wanted to be an artist and writer and performer. And maybe, Malika, you could start. And
well, I often refer to it as being a species, that you're born the species. I think I was expressing myself creatively from a very young age. The earliest I recall is kind of the five-year-old performances at granny's concerts, you know, like at Christmas or family gatherings, where I'd be running the show and showing my latest dance moves or my aspirations to be a ballerina or whatever. And then just creative writing. I think writing poetry or journaling was something that came very naturally to me, and a love for reading and books and stories, which I think is influenced by the fact that my dad is someone who loves words also, but less the reading. He likes to be the teller and the passer on of proverbs, cliches as they may be as well. And my mom, voracious reader, and both of them used to fight about whose skills I'd inherited, really, in terms of playing with words. I studied theater because that's the emergence of the word and the performance. But I also think that comes from indigenous traditions in South Africa or Africa as a whole. And then arts management, because, you know, you can study your art form, but if you have no idea of what it is to market your art and what business skills you need, or, you know, law, arts law-related matters, you're setting yourself up for some major self-sabotage, I think. So my writing has always been really my mother tongue, and it's not necessarily language, but words as a form of really articulating meaning and creating what I feel are gifts for the people that I share them with.
Well, I mean, let me ask Chantal to talk about the same thing.
I'm a member of a family for whom the oral tradition is a very natural. It's a part of who we are. I grew up surrounded by stories, surrounded by words. My grandparents were my first caregivers, and you know, if I asked a question, they fed me a story. You know, it was never just one word answers. It was a long river meandering. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it was a beautiful environment to be in. Again, a value for words, a value for stories. And as a result, it's a natural part of who I am. It's my language. And it's something that I see, it's a family. It's not a family trait, but it's a family calling, because my mother herself is a storyteller. She's a woman who's written plays. She's performed all over the world. So while my relationship with words has changed, so first, very strongly an oral tradition, a sense of making meaning and creating with words, I began to write much later in my life, when I felt that there was a need to document the stories that I had inherited, the stories that I had heard, the stories that I felt were inside of myself, to recognize my family, to recognize their journey, their ancestral journey, their trajectory, but also to recognize the other storytellers in my family. Because I realized that if people just tell stories, they can quite easily pass away with the people who pass away, you know, whereas if you commit those stories to paper, if you record them, you know, or you put them out into a public space, or you produce a play, it gets video recorded, that work takes on another life. You know, it can travel. Other people can receive it. Storytelling is as much a part of who I am as the color of my hair or the, you know, the shape of my eyes. Yeah. It's what I do. Whatever context I find myself in, I find myself drawn to stories, other people's, or looking for the, you know, the thread. Where are the stories here? What are the stories that can be told? I'm very inquisitive. I'm always asking why, what, what's to learn? You know, what's new here? You know, and so I think, yeah, I hope I'm answering your question, but storytelling comes very, very naturally to me and through me.
Yeah. Well, that's, I guess, over time I've had the opportunity to talk with a number of writers, and that's something that seems to come through again and again, that's when you ask someone why they write or what the impulse is, they, so often people say, well, it just is. It's there. I somehow feel that it's always been there.
Yeah. It's kind of addictive also, because for me, there's always been therapeutic value in writing. When the world outside me didn't make sense, or when I felt blocked up internally, whether that's mentally or emotionally, this was a way where you could expel that overload, where I could detox with things that I felt were toxic to keep in to myself. And if I didn't want to express it verbally, I still used words, but on the page. And I didn't recognize, I think, right until high school, when I started to share that with my teacher and receive some kind of affirmation, or with my mom or dad, really intimate audience, if you like, that I recognized that my way with words was potentially a unique talent or something that I could develop. And the scenario of it becoming a career that would be the forefront of what I do really was not visible to me. I didn't know that this is where it would lead me. It's obviously also in the context of South Africa. There weren't many role models that looked like me, came from the places I grew up under apartheid, that represented that form of success and possibility. It's definitely something that only came to me in my early 20s, really, recognizing that this thing I'm doing that brings me so much joy, that heals me, that seems to catalyze processes for other people when I say it out loud, could become my work. And now it's hallelujah. This is what I'm doing.
I want to affirm that, because I think that that's also for me why it, I mean, it might have felt natural and it might have felt like a language, the way you learn English or whatever your mother tongue is. Mm. But the affirmation that I received from my elders, from people around me, from my teachers, from my peers, certainly shone a light and, you know, gave it more impetus. I felt that people saw me when I told stories, when I performed. I felt that they really saw me, you know. Mm. And I think that that's an essential part of what, as human beings, we all are looking for, you know, that kind of recognition, that kind of affirmation, that I'm unique, that my voice is unique, that people see me as who I am.
Mm. I think, though, that makes me think about, I'm sure that for a lot of people who write, that whether it's really obvious or whether they acknowledging obvious in an obvious way, that partly what they're doing is they're writing as a way of trying to figure out who they are.
Yes,
absolutely.
And it seems that particularly for the two of you, I think that quest.
He's hit the button now.
Definitely. You know, I mean, I think a big part of my work, at least my playwriting, has been about trying to piece together myself through piecing together my family's story, you know, uncovering places of secrecy, places of silence for various reasons. I mean, I think if you know anything about apartheid South Africa, there are big gaps in the recording of history. And certainly there was one narrative that was dominant under apartheid, you know, and that was the narrative of white South Africans, you know. So if you were a person who was black or a person of mixed racial ancestry, as I am, there were no easy places to go and find the answers to the questions that you had. Where do I come from? Who am I? How did we get here? You know, and also, you know, who am I in my entirety? Not just who does the government say I am? Because, of course, that always felt false, felt like a very false construct. And I could see that while the adults around me were not buying into it necessarily, but were accepting it, that they themselves were fragmented, you know, they themselves were dislocated. And I really wanted to know why were they quiet about certain members of the family? Why didn't they have all the strands and the threads of the stories? And I want to really recognize that my grandfather, my mother's father, who is not my mother's biological father, but who certainly is my grandfather, even though we don't share DNA, he was an amazing storyteller. And when he told me the story of his life, which he would do consistently, I always had the sense that I was living in that time. And for me, that's another powerful motivator, the feeling of being able, you know, through words and with stories and also with truth, being able to stand in another time is so rich that it's something that certainly motivated me to pursue those stories, find out who are these people, where did they come from, and then also to recognize them and honor them in my writing, you know.
I definitely agree with that in terms of, even in the introduction to one of my first poetry collections called Born in Africa, but I'm saying that I started out writing for myself, but realized later that I was writing from the self. And for me, that bigger self is the part of myself that's the unknown territory, the part that's still being revealed as I gain life experience, as I grow, as I encounter things coming through me that I don't necessarily feel are mine, but are coming to me. Mm-hmm. And also the notion that we teach best what we most need to learn. I think telling and listening, you know, for me, writing is about a deep, the quality of my writing is about the quality of my listening, the depth to which I can go to that still place when I'm listening to someone else or in my own life, in order to hear what needs to be spoken about, told, healed, reconciled. And that reconciliation aspect or healing or therapeutic is really a core motivation for me in my work, is the power of this form of creative expression in terms of integrating those lost, fragmented, suppressed, broken pieces of ourselves.
Just very quickly, I'd like to introduce again the guest for anyone who might have tuned in. This week, the University of Illinois is hosting a week-long festival celebrating African women writers. This is something that is happening both through the work, hard work of folks in the Department of Theater and also the Center for African Studies. So this will be something that will be happening now every other year to look at writers of the African diaspora. And this time, for the very first event, they're concentrating on the writings, plays, novels, poetry, short stories of women writers. And two of the guests, the special guests who are here for the festival, Chantal Snyman and Malika Ndlovu, are both here in studio with me. They're both from South Africa. Malika is a poet, playwright, and Chantal is an artist. She's a singer, actress, writer, all of that?
Oh, yeah, I'm a performer. I wouldn't necessarily call myself a singer. I mean, I sing in the shower, but I don't think that qualifies.
Okay. I think you're a little bit better than your average shower singer. But that's just my opinion. And again, there are a lot of things happening this week in connection with the festival. One good way that you can find out what's going on, go to the websites of either the Center for African Studies or the Department of Theater, and you can see a schedule of all of the events and see some of the people that are here and some of the things that they'll be doing, and you might want to take in some of those. And questions, welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. One of the things I read about Weave, this collective, this women's writers collective that Malika was involved in founding, was that one of the reasons that it was started was partly because it was difficult for Black women to be published, but also because you were hearing things from publishers saying, like, you know, enough of the writing about the struggle, okay? Enough about apartheid. Let's find something else to write about. And apparently there were plenty of writers who were saying, no, I don't think that we've said all there is to be said about this. This is really important. And I guess I'm interested in how it, you know, both this idea that as a writer you feel that there are important things to be said, but then you've got to have some way to get them out there, and how it is you struggle with the people who are in the distribution business who are saying, well, you know, that's really not what we're interested in.
Oh, it's not going to sell.
Yeah.
How do we sell this?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think Weave is a wonderful place to start. Just historically, if I look at the last 10 to 15 years, in which there's been obviously a lot of social transformation and a lot of sharing of power in various sectors, the publishing industry around writing in general, South African work has definitely, we're in a time of flourishing. I'm very excited to be heading to the London Book Fair in about 2 weeks' time, where there's a specific South African focus for the London Book Fair, and where about 100 independent publishers and authors will share work, represent, do launches, etc. This is an exciting time because in the time that we've existed in the late 90s, we were the fresh end or the cutting edge of an entire history in which the very few black women's writings were usually published elsewhere, or were the same ones that had been republished again and again, our grandmothers' basically writings, the few that we could count on one hand, or male writings that also didn't necessarily represent our experience or voices. So coming together as an intergenerational group was a historical thing. And then the notion of self-publishing felt like the most rational way to go forward, because if we were going to be censored in terms of what you can write about, and also the genre that you have to be confined in one publication, we had decided we wanted a collection of writing that could be multi-genre. And that, again, makes it challenging for some publishers in their minds that we can't sell this. I want to know if it's poetry. I want to know if it's short stories. I want to know if it's plays. And we felt there is so much that we have to share. Each one of us is writing in more than one genre, and we will self-determine, basically. So it became this mixed basket, and it was fantastic that an independent publisher at the time was willing to take the risk with us in terms of, literally, they're not really a publisher at that stage. They were our printing company that said, we'll do the layout and we will edit as in spell check, but we will not tell you what to write, which was fantastic. And I think when you have a group, a consciousness around something and the conviction is strong or intention about that, things can change. Because we manifested that book. We printed only 250 copies of Ink at Boiling Point, it was called. And we sold at least 50 copies at our launch. And subsequently, the book, the three reruns have been sold out. The book is now no longer in circulation because the group has grown and, in a way, dissipated. But it's still very much the case that black women writers are challenged in terms of getting their works published, but relative to the time that even Weave was doing it, it's a far more. The opportunities are greater. The exposure is greater. There's actually also something we did discuss in the group was, yes, we have a lot about our own experience under apartheid that we wanted to release, to tell, to document. But we'd also like to write about erotica, if you don't mind, you know, or we'd like to write comedies, you know. And so we felt at that early stage that we were had a responsibility to speak to our missing histories and voices. But slowly you have younger generations of writers and even women who are expressing a gay or lesbian experience and people who are writing chick lit as it is categorized and like kind of send-ups and sci-fi or, you know, fantasy, which is fantastic because to me that is true liberation, is when you are really feel free that your blackness and your South Africanness does not define or confine what it is that you write. Because to be a writer is a universal species. It's not a South African species. Yeah. That's just the richness of your music with words that can come through. But I want to be free to write about anything I choose. Mm-hmm. And I am lucky to be in a generation that is experiencing that level of possibility, which wasn't there not so long ago.
Yeah. Yeah, and is getting an opportunity to experience their own complexity.
Absolutely. You know? Not being confined to the struggling black woman.
Absolutely.
One thing I would like, because I believe that you, the two of you, have worked together.
Yes.
I'm interested in maybe having you talk about collaboration. And one thing I was quite fascinated by the notion that and Chantal, you were talking a little bit about your mom being a storyteller and people in your family being a storyteller and that being something that you sort of came by honestly. I was very interested to read about this play. You did a play actually with your mom and then performed it with your mother and your sister. It was Conversations with My Ex.
We actually, my mother and I have done a lot of work together, and it's been a very, very interesting journey because my mother's a very strong woman, but our styles of storytelling are very different. And in the creation of our work, I have normally taken the lead in terms of creating the piece, writing, and she has taken the lead in other aspects. So organizationally, the marketing, we produce our own work, which is, a labor of love. But at the same time, it's very empowering because it means that we've had a sense that we can do it. And because we can do it, so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because we can do it, we do it, you know. We create the work, we perform it, we market it, and we reap the benefits. You know, we don't have to profit share with anybody, which in South Africa is an issue because the truth is that it's not so easy to get funding for creative projects, at least not in the city that I live, which is Durban. Mm-hmm. You've got to kind of, you know, broker deals, beg, borrow, that kind of thing. And I prefer not to work that way. I really prefer to have ownership of my work. Obviously, it would be delightful to have the work sponsored or the work commissioned. And I'm sure that's going to happen at some point. But for now, it's been, you know, beginning to end, owning the process. Working with my mother, back to your question, is, it's loaded because we are mother and daughter and we have different ways of expressing ourselves. We also have different attitudes towards creating and towards truth, You know, there are. My mother has a style where she wants to replicate the truth. So she literally wants to take the truth of her truth and she wants to put it, you know, in the space. Whereas for me, you know, one has to work with that truth. One has to recreate. One has to come from a point of, yeah, one has to distance yourself. I think it also is complicated because we do work with actual family stories and events, either things that have happened to one of us or things that have happened to one of us that have affected all of us. So it's complex, it's rich, it's layered. It's not always easy, but I accept that at the outset. I've been working with her for a long time. I've also been her daughter since the day I was born. So, you know, it's it's kind of like, and what's really beautiful for me is that we've come around to new understandings of one another, just not just as mother and daughter, not just as people who are related, but as women. And also as artists. My sister didn't perform Conversations with my ex, which incidentally started out as some kind of therapeutic writing about my parents' divorce, about the event that actually catalyzed the divorce, but which turned into a whole other world. And that's what I love about writing. It turned into a story not about my family, but about some other family, which, of course, it is. You know, it could be a story about anybody's family. It also turned into a story about people's relationship with truth. And at the time that I wrote it, we as South Africans were grappling with Jacob Zuma, who wasn't yet our president, and the corruption trial, you know, and people within families were divided as to whether or not, you know, this is something that we should go ahead with. Should we explore, you know, the level of his involvement? So it really spoke to me about people's attitudes and relationship with the truth. Some people wanted it out there. Yes, let's talk about it. Let's pursue it. Let's see how far it goes. And other people were like ostriches. Heads in the sand. No, leave it alone. Let's not ruffle the wood. This man is going to be president soon. We don't want, you know, we don't want to stir things up. We don't want more division than there already appears to be. So, yeah, it turned into something else. And, you know, that's what I love about writing, because, you know, you think you know what you're writing about, and then suddenly the story comes, the story that and wants to be over. Told. That's right. And needs you. To be told, you know.
Well, that's, I think it gets me thinking, maybe it's because of some recent conversations that I had, but it gets me thinking about whether either you're trying to rebuild a society after a society-wide tragedy or crisis, or whether an individual is trying to rebuild a life after a personal crisis. What do you do with the past?
They're totally interconnected, Ed. It makes sense. Even if I think about it, some writing facilitators always talk about, you know, the micro and the macro, about going into personal detail or as much detail as possible, because that specificity is what leads to universal relevance and resonance. It's from the, you know, I think we live constantly with notions of otherness, of separateness, of alien and foreigner, of indigenous and, you know, colonial. We've broken each other down into we're not like you. Even though we all have eyes, nose, legs, we are not aliens. We're not different species as such. And so, yes, I do really believe that also in a society where there's been people have a broken sense of even self-confidence and self-worth, even though the law may change and your president may be the man you voted in, that doesn't necessarily build you as an individual. And not all of us got to be, for example, on the TRC talking about the trauma or atrocities that happened in our own communities or families and what that did to our psyche as individuals. So people are at different levels of awareness, different levels of healing, different levels of access, education, ability to articulate their needs, etc. And that means that we cannot come from the paternal relationship we've had with our leadership and our politicians, for example, in the past, where we were forced to operate that way, looking for handouts, looking for them to be the solution to our problems, projecting our future, our country's future, and our next generation's hopes towards putting them in the hands of what looks like a circus right now. And I'm not ashamed to say it. You know, that's what our political landscape mm-hmm. looks like. Very scary. And So, feeling that each one of us has to take responsibility for our own lives, our own families, our own aspirations. We have to do our own healing work. And that can take many forms. But the reconciliation and reconstruction of our country is going to happen one person, one community, one family at a time. We are still very broken at that micro individual level. And it's not being acknowledged, and it's not a priority list in terms of the things we are transforming and changing. It takes time, it takes money, and it takes awareness and courage.
No, I agree. I think it takes courage, you know. It takes courage because everybody's story, everybody's trajectory is filled with pain because we have a pain-filled past. We have a past that is, you know, it's... There's shame, there's guilt, there's all kinds
blame.
Of blame, you know. Yeah, there's all kinds of resentment, hatred. There's all kinds of emotions that people don't want to face, they don't want to process because obviously they are painful. But for me as an artist, I really have the sense that if we don't do the work, as Malika has said, one person at a time, if we don't own that, you know what, If we want change, the only way for that to happen is to have the courage to take the first step forward, to work through that morass of whatever it is for each person, you know. And also, reclamation is also about courage, you know, not waiting for somebody else to help you discover who are you, you know, where did things go wrong for you or where does your family come from, but you having the courage, okay, I've said this so many times on campus in workshops and stuff like that. A lot of the elders, they don't know. They don't know not because they don't want to know, but they also don't know because they themselves were not told. They were not told by their mothers or fathers, where do we come from? So it's not just about older people withholding, you know, information that they could quite easily give us. And also memory is something that is, it's so tricky. You know, memory is... It's subjective and it's not reliable. So the onus is on each person, you know, to reclaim themselves.
And to be clear about what the intention is in doing that.
Yes.
Because if it was just about asserting a kind of people of color, specifically in South Africa, asserting a kind of black pride and empowerment and freedom, exclusive of any other, then we'd be basically inverting the process of oppression. Our reclamation has to be a collective one, and it has to be an inclusive one, and it has to be, yes, introspective work in our own families, our own communities. But those are not just like identity. The things that define community and self and identity are not concrete walls.
They're
Apartheid
not.
Tried to teach us that they were. But they are completely permeable, and we have been integrating, mixing, loving each other, communicating with each other, rubbing each other up the wrong way forever. Hence, we are here, the mixed ones.
Even under apartheid,
you know.
Exactly.
So it's really about, for me, my work, it would be easy for me to get on a righteous black anger platform in my own country and anywhere in the world, because I think if I raise that flag, if I do that on a gender level as well, anti-men or extreme feminist, I will get a whole horde of people who will go, yeah, 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 and we'll say all the right, you know, quotations and make the right noises. But that's, for me, not the whole truth. It certainly doesn't nourish me. And my question is, again, what is your intention? Do I want to bring up the old fires for the sake of doing so I can look like the leader, the voice, the face of, you know, protest? Or am I authentically interested in shifting what that pain is about? I'm interested in a vision of something new. I want to talk about something we possibly cannot yet see or we've lost confidence in believing in. I want to draw out the threads of commonality between us, a remembrance of the fact of where this breaking down began.
And also reclamation allows you to transform and to transcend. If that was your intention is,
yeah.
You know, to tell the story in your own way, in a way that makes sense to you.
I want, for people maybe who've been listening for a while, I want to, again, to introduce the both of you so people know who it is they're listening to. We're talking this morning with two artists from South Africa. The last person you heard, that's Chantal Snyman. She is artist, cultural worker, actor, writer. Malika Ndlovu is here as well. She's a poet and playwright, and they're both here to take part in a festival. It's a week-long festival celebrating the work of African women writers. And the Theater Department and Center for African Studies are the sponsors. And there's a lot of things going on that people might want to be aware of. You can go to the websites of either African Studies or Theater, and you can find out more. That's probably, provided you have internet, that's probably the easiest way to get onto the schedule. And I don't know if there is a particular event that you might like to mention?
Sure, definitely. I'm performing a selection of my work as a performance poet. I've called it Born in Africa, but after my first anthology, it'll be a two-hour session. The first hour will be pretty much me performing and sharing my work and the stories of where those pieces come from, and then an open discussion with audience if they're interested in having it beyond. And I also have copies of my four anthologies, actually, on sale and a CD or two. And that's happening on Stage 5 at the Cranet Building on the campus. And then Chantal and I are, the work that we're here to present is my play, A Colored Place, which was also published by University of Illinois professor, Dr. Kathy Perkins. And so this play, we are performing extracts of it amidst the work of other African women writers who are featured. And Chantal's performing it, and that happens at the Armory each night. From 7,
Friday.
Yeah, so it starts Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and an extra performance at 3 p.m. on Sunday at the Armory. Yeah.
So, and these things are all free, and anybody
Absolutely.
Who wants to come on down
should
feel welcome.
Welcome.
Yes.
Very good.
On Saturday in particular, a Saturday afternoon from 1 to 6 at Temple Buell, which is also on the campus, there's a full African Day celebration, African food, African music, drumming, celebrations of extracts of all of our work, and that's open to all ages. We're specifically looking at it as a community celebration of all things African. And I think the richness and diversity of what you'll experience there would be the most valuable.
Okay, great. I want to come back to politics for a second and connect it with art. And I'm thinking about the fact that when apartheid came to an end, I think that there were a lot of people that were very hopeful about what that would mean, and that particularly life for everyone in South Africa, but particularly people who are not white, would improve. And the man who became the president, one of the most admired men in the world, Nelson Mandela.
Mm-hmm.
Then the guys who came after had the unenviable job of being the successor to Nelson Mandela. Now, I don't know how anybody does that.
I know. It's not doable.
It's not. You might as well forget it. And I'm sure that there was, maybe for good reasons, people were disappointed with Thabo Mbeki. And there are now probably people who are not particularly happy with Mr. Zuma, Jacob Zuma, who is the current president, and disappointed that things have not improved to the extent that they would like. And certainly South Africa is still facing a lot of problems, crime and poverty, and it's not the place people would like it to be. And right at the moment, things seem to have gotten to a rather frightening pitch with the recent murder of one of the country's most notorious white supremacists, Eugene Terblanche, and this controversy about the singing of the old apartheid song, Kill the Boer, which it seems to me like that's pretty counterproductive. But,
totally.
You know, that's not, I'm not on the scene, so I can't say. So given that great hope, great disappointment, still a lot of racial tension, can art do anything about that? You know, what for the work that you do, what can you say about people about about where we are and where we might go?
Well, I want to dive in because a lot of the work that I am doing in my home city of Durban is using art. And not just the art that, you know, that I'm most comfortable in, which is theater and storytelling, but using art to create change in people's lives at a micro level, but change nonetheless. So And there are many initiatives like this around the country where artists are going into communities and working with women predominantly, in my case, women and children, to create change in those people's lives. Last year, I did a project with a group of women from Cato Manor. And Cato Manor was a site of, which was the biggest site of forced removals in South Africa, yet it's not as well known as Sophia Town.
Or District 6.
Or District 6. So when the apartheid laws were created and people were designated by race to live in certain areas, you know, thousands of people were moved from Cato Manor. So it's a place that has a charged history, and it's a place of tension and conflict because, you know, when apartheid was ended, as you put it, the people moved back. Mm-hmm. But not just the people who, you know, historically had not let go of it as a home, but people from other places who saw an opportunity to settle close to the city. And people who were immigrants from neighboring countries like Mozambique, like Zimbabwe. So it's a place of poverty at the moment, and it's a place of great tension. And I did a project with women who were unemployed. All of them had no skills or very little formal education. And they ranged from about 18 to about 60 in age. And initially I went in because one of the theatre companies that I work with in Durban, we specifically work in the arena of puppet theatre. We use puppet theatre as a social intervention. So we went in and we had all these ideas about how we would teach these women to create puppets. And then we thought, what could we do? You know, well, we teach them to create puppets, and what will we do? And we thought, okay, we'll teach them to create puppets that, you know, have a specific Durban, a specific South African identity. And what we'll do is we'll market those puppets. You know, we'll market them to either hotels or lodges who are always looking for unique installations of African art. And it went well, you know. Most of them proved to be naturally very creative. But something else also came out of the process. After the puppets were created, the women seemed less interested in marketing the puppets than in using them to tell their own stories. So we began to workshop a theatre piece, pulling strands of each woman's story into this production. And in the process, what we realized is that these women, they wanted to see themselves represented. They wanted to tell their stories. They wanted to give a voice to their experiences. Now, that represents a change. It represents a shift. They were taking ownership of their own stories, of their lives, in a sense, you know. The kind of change that I feel myself and other fellow artists are doing is that we're trying to make a difference where and how we can, you know. And I think art has transformative possibilities because you start with nothing most times, and at the end you have something. So it teaches about a process, but it also teaches about yourself and your abilities. That, you know, if
the power
if
you that are, you have within
that you have the power of creation, that we are all creators, you know.
I also feel, Ed, that we are in a challenging time in South Africa because historically the arts, if you think about our history of protest art in all the genre, were always part of dealing with the socio-political issues and situation. And during censorship and cultural bannings and boycotts, that was the only form in which that political activism was free to some degree, and where interracial or cross the racial lines, people were engaging with each other, making protest, getting works and messages to the rest of the world about what was actually going on. And in our newer dispensation, we have had to lobby and in a way re-educate the same comrades, if you like, mm-hmm. who were on that side of the fence with us, struggling in their own fields of expertise and skill, to recognize the role and value that the arts play. And often what's happened in this very commercial Rainbow Nation cosmetic version of what South Africa is, the tourist, you know, export version of what we are, has been put as a priority because of what it can generate economically for South Africa, but also because that's the... We have to keep the hype. You don't want to keep telling a story of we fell from Madiba Foria, you know, down to where we are. It isn't the whole truth. It isn't as clear a descent. But yes, there are a lot of mixed feelings, a lot of disillusionment, a lot of cynicism that has returned, and rage for the most poor people who have actually in some ways gotten poorer. Where literal things like housing, hospitals, bare necessities are exacerbated by xenophobic issues, by AIDS, HIV and AIDS, domestic violence, violence against children, crime, all of those ills that are totally integrated with poverty and economic issues just keep swelling and seething parallel to some really phenomenal things that are happening.
Yeah.
What's interesting is Chantel has also worked with soccer players, and we are in the 2010 field.
I wanted to ask about that. Yes.
So
yes.
We are. There's another kind of euphoria going on, and it's parallel to this extreme, as I said, political carnival, which is not a funny one. It's a black comedy, and in every sense,
It's full of irony. And as you're talking, I'm realizing that that's like it's almost like a South African paradigm. There's always
like that clown.
You know, these extremes. You know, these extremes of euphoria. Absolutely, the joy of being. I mean, because it's still very much present in society. The joy of being a democracy, of being able to self-determine, live where you want to live, choose. You know, people. The things that bind or lock people down now are economics. You know, you can move if you are able to move, you know, but that choice wasn't available under apartheid. I mean, even if you had some kind of economic empowerment, you couldn't choose where you wanted to live. So there's still that celebration, that I feel that joy is still something that's literally cooking, you know, in our society. But at the same time, as Malika has so well articulated, there are always these tensions, these opposing forces. You know, HIV and AIDS is huge in South Africa. It is huge. I sit on the South African National AIDS Council as part of the Sports and Recreation Committee. And when I look at the statistics, some part of me feels like, you know what, I can't think statistically, because if I continue to engage with those statistics, I'm just going to have no hope for the future, you know, for my children, for Malika's children, for everybody's children. It's just like the rate is just climbing, regardless of the
All
myriad
the
of social interventions, you know, of political interventions. Okay, there was a period, you know, where there was no political intervention, you know, which kind of set all the efforts back.
Or that you could take a shower and it would all be cured.
It would all be erased, you know. So it's for me, it's the place to be. It's the place for me to be working. Exactly, you know. It's the place for me to be writing, to be creating, to be taking... to be helping other people, to facilitate their stories, also to facilitate their healing, their transformation, their transcendence, because I know it is possible. I know on a personal level, and I also know
we have lots of stories of transcendence and hope that give us motivation in terms of what we're doing.
Absolutely.
Because we're relatively resourced, educated, have more access than a lot of people. And we are doing the work we love and eventually getting paid for it, which is truly surreal.
I wanted to add,
landscape.
We are relatively courageous. Because
yes, it's relative.
Because yes, we are.
But when we work with the people that we work with, if I go into the environments where there are mass teen pregnancies or drug abuse or domestic violence or gangsterism, the groups that I'm working with, whether it's gender along gender lines, because it's equally traumatic on either side. I have three sons. I care a lot about South African males are experiencing, even white males who are the most invisible right now. I mean, not necessarily on our political landscape, but in terms of fears, experiences, feeling marginalized, feeling voiceless, like their stories are no longer relevant, etc. Very challenging. And also because if people are all on one campus or all in one classroom, how does that dynamic make any sense if we are sharing space and have freedom to do so. For all of that, it's very challenging work. It's very rewarding work. And we are humbled by the people that we do work with. I don't think we're ever really going to be interested in doing art for art's sake or navel gazing because it's the work is in our face.
Absolutely.
Well, we're just about at the point we have to finish. I'm really sorry that we can't keep going. I did want to hear about the soccer players, about what you're doing with the soccer players. Not just because I'm a guy, but I just thought, well, no, that sounds pretty interesting. Just real quick, what is the project?
Well, it's a project called Show Me Your Number. And in soccer, I don't know if you know anything about soccer, but, you know, when the guys show you their number, it's about protecting themselves. They turn their back when somebody takes a free kick or when they take a penalty. It's about protecting themselves and protecting their theme. So it's a play on protection. But also it's using professional soccer players, leveraging their status to create awareness around issues of HIV and AIDS.
Right, yeah.
But also positive images of masculinity, as Malika was saying, you know, positive images of, yes, that here are men, you know, who are sportsmen, who are paid well, who are, you know,
they're celebrities,
people adore them, you know, that here they are standing up and trying to make a difference, you know.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to stop with Malika Ndlovu and Chantal Snyman here for a celebration of African women writers. This is the festival going on this week, sponsored by the Department of Theater and African Studies. A lot of things going on in connection with the festival. There should be, around the campus, there should be some publicity. But again, maybe an easy way, if you'd like to find out what's going on, is go to either the website of African Studies or the Department of Theater, and you can see the complete schedule. And in addition to Malika and Chantal being here, there are other artists, performers. We talked with Hope Azeda on Monday from Rwanda, and there are a lot of really cool women here and doing cool stuff. So take in some of these events, and thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Pleasure.
Thank
what a joy to be here.
Much.
Stay well.